Excellent.
Oh my goodness. Well, we're finally here.
Mm-hmm. The long-awaited crossover.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking a picture. I'm going to send this to all of my exes, just so they know. Like, oh, I'm famous now. hi.
That's all you got, John, is hi?
Nice,
hi.
Nice.
I was waiting for something funny to happen, and I just said hi.
It's gorgeous.
This is really exciting. Hello, welcome to Disgorgeous. It's a podcast about wine. I'm Duck.
Hi, I'm the dumb one. And our guest today is Pascaline Lepeltier, who sort of doesn't need an introduction, but I'll do it anyway. Runs the wine program at Racine's, is a managing partner there, co-wrote The Dirty Guide to Wine, which I read on the train this morning. Pretty good.
Nice.
And pretty good. Just a million other things that we could talk about, but more than anything else, Chenin expert, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I got the t-shirts.
Oh, I love that t-shirt. Also responsible for all of our favorite sommeliers being lunatics.
Yeah, we have you to thank for Jim Sly being the way he is. So
I think James owns his own talents to himself. You know, he's naturally gifted.
We disavow him as well. I understand.
A lot of love for James Sly. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us on the hottest day so far of the year.
It's really gross out.
Sorry, I'm in the cellar right now. You don't see the cellar, but you see the vine. I thought it would be more poetic to be in a vineyard.
Kevin and I are in the same apartment. He's in my living room, and I'm in my boudoir, so this is very exciting. This couch is where Yuma sleeps at night, so it's
where the magic happens.
It's where all the magic happens, a lot of snoring.
Nice knees, I have to say. Look,
thank you. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is my first time wearing shorts, and I have to show them off for the fans.
The fun approve.
Thank you. Yes.
Oh man. So yeah, we're doing this is episode 3 of our Loire deep dive, I suppose you could call it. Although we're not going that. I mean, we're only doing 6 or 7 episodes. I feel like we could do 20.
We could probably just do a whole podcast in the Loire, which would be probably better than what we fucking do.
Yeah. but this is thankfully for an 80 degree day, the Chenin day and not the Cab Franc day. Cause that would be really rough.
Do you remember a couple of years ago, we did a Syrah episode on like a 95 degree day. And I remember just being so fucking pissed off.
Yeah. We did it though. Cause we're professionals.
Yeah. Real professionals. this is something I've been thinking a lot about, Chenin, in the Loire as, It's the good grape, quote unquote. Also, quote unquote over the quote unquote. It's like it's a recursive system of quotes. No one's really sure what it's referring to.
I love the meta system.
It's like whoa. It's like Inception, the movie. But for me, I'm wondering a lot. You seem to be responsible in many ways for Chenin being what it is. What was Chenin before you started doing your nefarious business? The hashtag Chenin, 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 Chenin. That's yours, right? You invented that saying?
The Chenin, Chenin, Chenin? Oh. No, I think there's a couple of guys in the Loire have to be applauded for that, you know. I just took it over the Atlantic and added the French accent. And it became like what it is today. Like, so we can sell t-shirts, you know, we can sell wine keys and all that. So
that's the ultimate aim of any sommelier is to sell some t-shirts.
That's definitely was a goal of my career. So yes. I think I can retire, like the merchandising effect.
So if there's a link, we'll put it in the podcast description. Well, we'd love to help you raise some money.
I should have trend marketed it, you know, but I was not American enough yet. So now I'm like, oh,
now we've ruined you enough.
No, actually. 7 years ago, I was still naive and young and all this kind of thing. So, But what can I say? I'm like, that's what's happening right now. It's absolutely fantastic for this grape. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And I'm for sure not responsible for it. That's because of the guys that you are drinking right now that mm-hmm. the whole thing happened. It's just, let's say it was serendipitous. I was at the right place and at the right moment. And that's pretty much how we got the door open for Shun in America. Mm-hmm. We think that Chanel today is going through this absolutely extraordinary period of time, but we still need to realize it's far from being the case, and this grape is still put out every single year in France. So what we are seeing is kind of more an attempt on our side to save probably one of the most interesting grape around. So that fairy tale was more than needed. Otherwise, we would have lost something quite, quite important. Situation was quite bad, and it's still quite bad, to be honest.
Yeah, it's weird. It's one of those grapes that seems to be really loved by the nerdiest people who drink wine, but normal people don't particularly like Chenin. They don't know what Chenin is, perhaps,
or what
it can be.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's quite simple. In fact, it's because Chenin is a kind of a beach of a grape. So to make a good Chenin, it's not mm-hmm. like to make a good Sauvignon and a good Chardonnay. It's a little bit more complicated and tricky. And so Chenin, it's why it's such an amazing grape. It can be absolutely everything for anybody, depending on how you're making it. So it can be the most boresome, insipid, worthless wine, as it can be the funkiest wine that you ever drank. And we have the whole spectrum, all the rainbow in the middle. And so for a while, just that grape was just not taken seriously by 99.9% of the producer, always using a different way. So of course, people were like, we have no idea what this tastes like, because one day is sweet and one day is dry and one day is clean and reduced and the other day is oxidized and sweet. So where I am, and we had to wait for people to really believe in it and to show that spectrum was not an issue, but was a real advantage of that grape. So it's a grape that definitely can throw you off because it's super edgy. And that's not necessarily something that you like. It's not the acquired taste that everybody has, especially when you grow up and you are not used to eat and drink stuff that are super sour or super bitter or have this very, very strange savory notes, and you're like, oh, I'm just liking that. So
it's also like it seems to be a repeating theme in the Loire Valley, but it's also a grape that in a way was a victim of its own certain successes. You know, thinking specifically about the sweeter styles of Chenin in the past, or like Sancerre becoming, you know, so beloved for a certain kind of just insipid style, or even Muscadet for that matter, kind of falling into this trap of like, oh, well, it can do this one thing, and we just like drive that into the ground. And then it becomes this sort of Herculean attempt by winemakers to be like, yeah, but we can do these other things with it if we actually try, and it could be more interesting. And it seems to happen in the Loire a lot. To even when we're talking about Grelot the other day, it's like there's more possibilities there than people give it credit for. And it seems like every grape in this town is like a kid down on his luck, like a underdog story, a Cinderella story kind of thing. I mean, do you think that's just inherent to the place, or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, I never thought about that this way, but I think that's quite pertinent. I think you are pointing something very true, that I don't think we realize how much phylloxera fucked up a lot of things. And how everything changed so dramatically that we are in the kind of the landscape where we are today. So with phylloxera, and the reputation of the grape you name, we can add Pinot de Nice on the other guy, and of course the Pinot Noir that you mentioned a lot, like in the Sancerre episode. like all these grapes were absolutely legitimate and they were really praised. Muscadet was a different story, as you know, because they were just stealing their stuff. But
Muscadet is our favorite, though.
it's unfortunate to only have Muscadet finally being respected for what it is. Muscadet is like Shona, like, you know, right now Muscadet is doing so bad that if people are not drinking Muscadet, it's literally what's happening there is like people from Cognac are buying vineyards and so they can distill more shit. So if we are not like saving Muscadet, it's really talking about saving, because we're talking about people that bankrupt and suicide and all that. We're not talking about a very happy place to be right now. But Phylloxera fucked up a lot, because when Phylloxera was kind of saved by grafting, which per se is a very problematic solution, grafting led to the idea that we were going to do more volume and more money. So from grafting parallel to hybrids, and you mentioned that, the Loire became kind of that productive center of grapes, and then you add the green revolution in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and what the only thing that mattered was quantity. And of course, as soon as you talk about this grape and you do quantity with it, we are just talking about a loss of understanding of true nature.
I have to interrupt you. I've never heard anyone use the phrase green revolution to talk about the West. I'm an ex-anthropologist, and we always talk about it when we talk about like rice farming in India. But I've never heard someone use that to talk about like the 50s, 60s, and 70s in Europe. Oh. But of course, it's the exact same thing. It's this idea that science will save all the farming, and that like the knowledge beforehand was kind of
crap.
It was, fuck it. They didn't know what they're doing. They were old, and we lost so much.
Yeah, it's funny because we talk, Green Revolution is quite used in French to talk about what happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s, especially more than ever right now. I think people are really realizing that that was...
continental theory is always well ahead of American theory.
No, but we have time to think. You know, it's part of the DNA. Like you are paid a couple of hours a day to think. Let's just think.
It's not a smoke break; it's a thinking break. I guess
it's a think. Some people smoke at the same time. It's like multi-talented. But that's and you're right. And Shona was famous for sweets, so Shona becomes chaptalized, and then we get clones that were just about making yield, and at the end you get something bad and. And you put everything on the flat and you lose the terroir characteristics. Mm-hmm. So a bunch of places like behind me is at the vine of Benoit. So that's why I wanted to have this background. So this is the Shona we are drinking. So that is Cab, but the Shona is behind. Mm-hmm. Below that is the Vallon, and you get the hill going down to the Layon. And there is nothing planted anymore, but it was planted pre-Phylloxera, got approved in kind of the crappy, flattier area were planted. And so at the end, you get something that has no taste. Yeast arrived and the rest is history. So you end up yourself drinking Shona that, you know, are like one of the very first thing I realized when I arrived in America is like everybody was describing Shona with the wet wool.
When was this? Just for record keeping. For my notes.
I arrived?
Yes.
I arrived in 2009.
John's been keeping the Pascaline Wikipedia page accurate, so he's going to update that.
Yeah, okay, cool. 2009, that is a million years ago in wine terms. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It was a Paleolithic.
Jesus. Was that grower champagne in Riesling, or was that before that?
That was just before that. I arrived, I think, the first... came to the US in 07, 08, and I think the first summer of Riesling was 09. So we are just at the beginning. Yeah, we are like just the transition. Summer of Riesling, the first one down in Lower East Side with Paul. So, of course, no Shona. And the Shona was like... stinking like wet fool, and the choice of producer was terrible. So I was like, wet fool is funny, we never talk about that when you talk about Shona. And this is where you realize how bad farming and winemaking took that grape back down.
Is this also an instance of like, I mean, because you are from the Loire originally, so for you drinking you maybe had more access to Chenin that was made the way it was supposed to. And in the market here, there just wasn't a demand for the well-made Chenins. And so the Chenin that you could find here was sort of this wet wool idea, or it just was...
What a strange tasting, though. Because also, who the fuck... Like, I'm trying to think of Americans in 2009. I can't imagine a lot of them were, like, sniffing wet wool. Like, this is a... It's a tasting note that's, like, completely arcane. It's one of those that has... It seems to have, like... It's like gooseberries. No one knows what a fucking gooseberry is. Like, it just sounds like you went to college.
No, that you know, there is definitely some anthropological research to do about a certain tasting term. I would love to know where this one came from. I would love to know who indeed went to smell the sweat of a madam before being shaved and trying to apply that to the Chenin. But I'm pretty sure it came from the UK. I'm pretty sure it's not the American to blame. I'm pretty sure it's the Brits to blame.
Specifically Wales.
I'm not going to be that... I'm going to keep it large to like...
But they love sheep there.
But but that's once again is you know my I have to admit I'm an extraordinarily lucky girl because my wine career started in one of the most exciting regions because I was from that place and I was once again at the right spot at the right time. So I started in wine in 2005, really wine, like wine in 2005, by tasting, and it was exactly the moment when Ben starting to make wine and Richard was over, like all what's happening again. I'm from Angers, so like I have all this little microcosm of people that started in the 80s with Nicolas Joly and Ménard and then Baudouin and all that, and they were already starting to be loud and they were like not even 10 minutes drive from my parents or my apartment. So when you start right away in the middle of that, you can only be a very, very lucky person. And suddenly like, you realize there is that and the rest is like bullshit. And that's pretty easy to understand. You don't need a lot of experience or any kind of, so it's why. And so I arrived in the US and that was exactly the moment also where Jane was around, Reed Reznor was around. You know, it was just the very beginning of all these guys, and they started to bring the right people, and it was the beginning of the explosion of a lot of alternative distributor. So that was exactly the right moment for the right timing. Pricing of wine was super reasonable. They were like looking to introduce this wine to the market. Nobody heard about them. You could buy them by cases if you wanted. And I had the platform with a pretty big restaurant, so here we go. You know, that's how it worked. So it's more all the forces.
Miguel, yesterday on our last episode, kind of traced like the knowledge like, Americans getting better at wine to the Jura, which is kind of how that's how I think about the last like. Say around 2010, 2011, you started seeing Jurassic wines on lists, and that seemed to have been opening the floodgates for the weirder parts. But I'm wondering if that's something that you agree with. Do you think that people were... What do you think... What's the question I want to ask? What was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of natural wine? Like, how did we move from, like... 2008, 2009, Americans not really drinking wine and mostly being, I think, anonymous industrial and moving to the stage where we're at right now, where at least Americans in big cities, natural wine is such a big thing. What's the missing link? Is it Chenin? Do you think it's Chenin?
Not necessarily. I think Chenin was part of the game just because you had an access to a certain amount of wine and with a very high quality already. Like you were suddenly getting wine from winemakers that could put in your glass stuff that were really mind-changing. Like when you get one of the glass, we are really talking about, wow, that's something really good and very different. And that more than certain other region, just that the Loire in general, not only Chenin, but the Loire in general was kind of ahead of the game with a style of wine that suited the change of palate and also suited a very new generation of consumer. Like, I think what the big stuff is, like, who drank wine? Like, when I arrived and was working Upper East Side, the drinker of wine were above 40 years old. You know, they were like travelers, cosmopolitan, wealthy people, education, super classic. They were drinking wine. And under that, it was cocktail and beer, you know. And what happened, that shift was with really this burst of 20 years old kids. I can say that because I'm way older. 21-year-old kid. sorry for that. When they arrived in the early 2010s. And they were like, okay, want to drink? Cocktails, yeah, like kind of the cocktail revolution, all the speakeasy, all that kind of was already a little bit behind, like up. Beer was like going into that crazy triple IPA trend, all that too big. And but both of them prepared the path to natural wine. And suddenly we get into that. That was all these new drinkers that never drank wine before, got into booze by other ways, were ready for way more alternative, well more strange, well more unexpected aromatics, no formal training whatsoever. And they got into it and they really just purely enjoy the pure sheer pleasure of drinking this wine. Because they were really, you could just feel how different and how good, even for like, how your body were reacting to that, and was a mind-changing experience. So, and that exploded.
The other thing that, like, I've been thinking about, you know, reading certain articles just about, like, the Loire in general, and the sort of, the opportunity.
Sorry, my next door neighbors are taking a shower. They do this all the time. It's a really fun feature. I can always tell when they're showering. I pay extra for it.
I hope.
The sort of like opportunity that existed in the Loire that seemed to drive people who were not, you know, fourth or 14th generation winemakers who wanted to try this. It seemed like the Loire was the only place available to a certain extent for them to purchase land of any reasonable amount to make wine seriously or to learn from other winemakers who are doing similar things. It seems like maybe 10 years before, 15 years before this started to obviously like become a thing here, like it had to have those seeds planted by people who moved to the Loire to make these wines this way, or to almost like in the face of these antiquated AOC rules and say, well, I don't care about those. I can make my VDFs and I can make wine the way I believe. And if it wasn't for this ability to have this place to go to where you could buy land and experiment and not be really ostracized for it, that allowed that to replicate in other areas around the world that became natural wine hotspots. Does that seem correct?
And I mean, I guess the just to hop on that, like the other thing I think that we forget is that they could have moved to other places, but those places didn't make good wine. Like the Loire was like specifically historic. It seemed like the Loire has been known as a wine place forever, and unlike the other good wine places, it feels like in the second half of the 1900s, you could afford you couldn't afford like land in Burgundy. You couldn't afford land in Bordeaux, but the Loire was seemed to have been fucked to death by capitalism in a way that made it like it was a fixer upper. But like people weren't like, okay, let's go to the Ardèche. They had to wait till like recently to do that. Or people weren't like because the you knew the Loire had the capacity for great wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bunch of really, really good points. And this is where you can't never forget that wine, as natural as it is just cultural, political, and economical, first and foremost. So everything is absolutely linked. So why is the Loire? I think it's not all the Loire. I think Anjou has a very specific part to play because Anjou, for a bunch of different reasons, from the fact that you can grow pretty much what you want, and you can also sell it in pretty much every style that you want. So that was a start. Okay, you could, whatever you were making, there was an appellation at least for the color, sparkling, sweet, still. That was still one thing that was attracting people. Land was definitely cheap, way cheaper in Anjou than it was even in Savonnières, or even Vouvray was more expensive, and of course, Sancerre was more expensive. Yes, historical attraction, great track record of world-class wines since 10th century, so you can't forget about that. Patrimony of old vine, you can also forget about that. And all the different grape varieties. So we are talking about Chenin, Sauvignon, of course, a bit of Chardonnay, your Menu Pinot, your Grolo, your Gamay, your Cabernet Sauvignon. So you had a bunch of different grape varieties. But what I think made the tricks is that you really had a couple of people that took on the risk. And it's very funny because it all came for different reasons. So Nicolas Joly is a big one. The fact that Nicolas came back, the fact that Nicolas randomly picked up a book or was given a book about Steiner and from J.P. Morgan started to become this apostle of biodynamy within 2 years on one of the greatest Coulisseon. When you go there, you are like, okay, that's the mass is said, like that's an extraordinary sight, you understand. So Nicolas was, I mean, Nicolas Joly, a personality like that was a big deal. Then the fact that two very important people came to the Loire for sweet wine. And after also being denied or like not finding what they wanted elsewhere. So the first was, of course, Marc Angeli. Marc Angeli is a very, very important person for the whole thing. And Marc from Provence, and he almost took over a vineyard in Provence because before he could do more stuff over there. And then the fact that he tasted some sweet wine during his school time led him to the Loire. And Marc is really responsible for a lot of the mess right now. But Marc came with such a different mindset, such a communitarist mindset. This man had the ball after the 1998, 1996 to change the sweet wine to make dry one, and then had the balls to tell them, fuck you, I'm leaving the appellation system, knowing that he was threatened by his neighbors, knowing that the tire of his car were like punched down, knowing that he got like dead animals in front of his farm. Like he went through a very big shit in the 1990s. He was really seeing a big threat, and he continued. He's such a stubborn man.
It's crazy really just to think about like the natural wine sort of journey in Loire starting with a desire to make sweet wine. Like that seems so opposite of what we would expect.
But
it seems like the thing we're also missing out. Like there's not a lot of natty sweet wine out there.
There is. Really? Just, like, no, there is a bit more than we think. And we should just, and I think the guys are also ready to make more. But no, like the Nazi guys, Domaine Les Griottes, their Graal was a sweet one with no sulfur. Chef Ardon does quite some. Richard stopped. But yeah, all the guys that we, you know, all the guys that played a big role, they all started with the sweet stuff. They all were fascinated by that, and they're still fascinated by that. But they're also fascinated by that botrytis. Like, it's go way beyond the sweetness. The whole thing that they're like that, that ability for liquid to get so much by that crazy fungus transformation stuff that was mind-blowing from them. But Marc came for that, Baudouin came back for that, and Patrick, he's not a natural wine world, played a very political part, very, very important in the back. Richard Leroy, of course, came for that, came for the sweet. And all these guys were also, they came with a certain maturity, knowing that they could say fuck to the system. And they found themselves very quickly. So they really became friends very quickly. Friends, you know, they yell at each other quite often. But
that's French friendship.
French, you know.
Frenemies, I think, is a phrase.
Friends and enemies, all that. You got a beautiful political way to wear. but they bonded together. They found the same echo in all the other region. They were very few of them, but had the same vision. And quickly, you had these four or five guys in Anjou, not really Saumur, not all these guys. It's very also don't forget, religion is also a big stuff. Mm-hmm. So where you are more Catholicism, Protestantism, more open, like it's really still yes. quite important all around.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So the fact that Angers was Protestant was also, So it's kind of helped a lot of the political side. But this guy were influenced by the Jura, were influenced mm-hmm. by a couple of people, of course, in Alsace, mm-hmm. Beaujolais, all that. They were getting together and they were kind of all realizing they were strong enough to mm-hmm. to do something different. And then they were very generous because they started with no money. They started with nothing. There is this idea of friendship and camaraderie that was very, very important, mm-hmm. sharing tools and sharing, helping each other, really helping each other against the system, against the corporation, against the big estate, against the bullshit they were listening to. And they realized that it was also the way to continue to grow. So both Richard and Mark have been essential about, especially Mark in by of mentoring a bunch mm-hmm. of people. And also keeping a certain integrity in terms of price point and in terms of quality of wine and in terms of also telling them, guys, you need to know how to make this a possibility. Because we had this, you probably heard about Eric Calcutte, that was a mm-hmm. previous owner of Les Nourrissons. Well, Eric makes these crazy wines and then mm-hmm. just left to go dance in Israel and now he's back in Ardèche. But you had other example of guys that started and just crashed down. And so there was also this idea that, guys, we need to hold to be strong enough for mm-hmm. to make a living out of that yeah. so we can make sure it's possible.
We talked a little bit about this in our season about aging wine and age with wine. And we talked about how, like, when you're in wine long enough, you get to see the sort of the producers that came and then went, which is a weird
it's such a
concept. When you feel like when you get into wine, you feel like for some reason wine is different than everything else, where like mm-hmm. you know, estates last for 11 generations and the son takes over and the mm-hmm. next son takes over, but like some people make a splash and can't cut it and leave, and you see that happen and it's like you kind of forget that part of winemaking. You think about, oh, this like perennial or annual, I can't remember which is which.
Perennial
kind of like idea of wineries, and they are like very much at the whim of not just, well, we can talk about climate in the Loire for sure, but also like the whim of what's popular, the whim of what can sell, and the whim of their own strength to continue to do something that maybe they believe in, but not the whole world believes in. So it's just good to remember that, I suppose.
We forget the human elements too. Like I was talking to an importer the other day who was like mentioning someone's 2019s were harvested too late because they were going through a breakup. And like you think, like, we like to think that wine is different than every other human activity in that like people can put aside all their bullshit and make wine. But like, absolutely, like people's personal lives come into this, which is one of those things that like it's a story that we don't talk about enough, which is like the way a wine tastes the way it's not always because of everything they were doing, but the things they weren't doing or the things they were ignoring or the things that got in their way. Like it's a profoundly human endeavor that I don't think we get enough, we don't spend enough time talking about it.
Especially for the wine we are talking about. It's absolutely untrue for a bunch of larger estates with a salary team that, you know, year in, year out, you have to produce a wine that is curable and you can make enough money out of. But like every wine we're talking about right now, and I think the wine we care about and we want to drink are wine where, yeah, it's made by people you can shake hands, you can mix mm-hmm. the kids. There is a lot of personal stories. There is some sad stories. There is some happy stories. There is some moments where they can't overperform. And I think right now it's even very complicated because there is such, like within five years with social media, especially, you get really in the intimacy on even more. And you have also a world exposure. So I know for certain winemakers, it's really hard to deal with because, you know, you are kind of expected to deliver or to do something, you know, yes. And it's a way different relationship to what originally they were starting. When they started, they were it was just their place, their wine, and what they were doing, whatever they wanted to do. And now it's like you are expected, you know, certain people feel like a pressure about that. Mm-hmm. And it's so how do we negotiate that? All of us, huh? How do we, because we all participate to that, new fame, new starification, new whatever you want to call it. How do you promote and you praise and you support the work of somebody without giving that an unnecessary pressure, especially mm-hmm. with what's happening right now, and give that person the ability to do what the fuck he wants when he wants to do it, and to deliver or not deliver, or like do what he can, you know. So that's some are stronger than others being able to do that, but it's definitely an issue.
This might be a good time to get into the wines we're drinking, or tasting.
Yeah, for the first wine, the Francois Saint-Lô, Les Pouches, I mean, that's almost exactly what we're talking about. It's this weird collective. He lives in a cave in
you're in Berry.
Berry, yeah. Wait. He lives like underground with like a motley collection of, like, he's like a blacksmith. There's a barrel maker.
Sounds like Zelda.
A mailman. It's like Zelda. It's extremely like. I was reading an article on Wine Anorak about him today, mm-hmm. and I almost got sick realizing how much I want this lifestyle. Like, I want a cave with all of my friends.
A real troglodyte.
I haven't been yet to the troglo of François. I saw the troglo.
Troglo is like such a good phrase.
Yeah, sorry, it's how we say.
Oh, that's so good. No, I'm losing it.
So Troglo, I had friends living in Troglo. You call that, it's Troglody, but you said, you come to my Troglo. It's like.
If anyone invited me to a Troglo, I would explode. I'm too much of a Francophile to like not lose it. Like,
I'm just imagining some more Tinder with all these like, hey, I live in a Troglo. Mm-hmm. Come hang out.
It's a swipe left for that, yeah. Right?
Swipe left for some natty fermentation. Swipe right if you pitch yeast.
Yeah. No, but yeah. So I haven't, unfortunately, I haven't made it yet, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm from the dark side of Anjou. So when we go to bright side of Anjou, it's like you cross a border, you know. Like
Darth Pascaline.
Yeah.
From the dark side.
I need to go, that's for sure. It's the problem is when you go from Angers to Berry, it's roughly 35 minutes drive, and you have 40 winemakers you want to stop by on the, so it kind of, it's a long trip.
That sounds terrible,
what François is doing is quite awesome. This tradition of Troglo and people living together and communities has been there for quite some time, as I have to say. I when I was a teenager, I already knew people living like that. And this
it
insane
sounds like
cave.
Peter Pan.
Yeah, it's really quite like, in fact, what is very funny is the very first time it's interesting you pick this wine, because the very first time I went to taste Ben's wine, Ben's was living in was making wine in a Troglo also. Mm-hmm. And indeed, you enter, you have this insane cave, and indeed, one guy was making cider, there was a leather man in the back, and the guy was like doing some stone sculpting. And you are all underground, and you can walk for miles, and they were doing this large fight. And it is really you are in the Lord of the Rings. Like, it's really like that. There is, you know, the temperature is the same. The light is very interesting, because you have these pockets of for ventilation. So mm-hmm. very often you have this dwell. Mm-hmm. So you have this very tamed kind of light. Mm-hmm. But you are in another universe. But it's been, once again, there is something in the south of Angers. We had always a lot of people coming from different kind of background and kind of hippies and alternative mm-hmm. thinking, a lot of circus people. And so they were all living.
Yeah, circus Troglo kind of, sounds powerful.
Yeah. And I have quite some friends that live in Troglo, in fact, like that, in communities. Mm-hmm. And it got kind of bigger and bigger. And so I'm not surprised that, like, François I didn't meet him much. I know Maurice's sister, Justin, who wrote that really amazing book, by the way. Like, I think it's one of the best comics about wine. If you read that in French, Pur Jus.
Oh, okay.
Pur Jus, that's one of the very best comics about wine. And Justin does the label for his brother. So.
Oh, okay.
But François, I met him a couple of times, and he has an extraordinary sensitivity. Like, the guy has a touch. Like, you can feel this kind of this wild new style of community where rules are so out of the classic capitalistic rules of community today. Like, he has created something where he can absolutely express himself. And the vineyard I saw from him, not with him, but I know vineyard that he has, and he worked at some winemaker straight to me, and superb vineyard work. And every time I tasted with him and talked to him, he's a very special character in the whole universe of personality.
He seems it. I know so many people who are obsessed with his wines. I've only had bottles of his, like, half drunk the next day, and oftentimes I'm like, I don't understand exactly what everyone's talking about. This is my first time, like, really just getting. And this for me, this wine's fucking fabulous. It's weird. There's a certain kind of Chenin-y abrasiveness that I adore, but like, there's a real touch on this wine for me. I don't know what everyone else is feeling about it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like having it be open in the glass for a while, the more sort of in your face, like, aromatic qualities have died down a little bit, and some really beautiful fruit notes are coming out in the glass, which is really compelling to me right now.
It was sparkling when we poured it. It was right. It was an absolute, like, is this a beer? But which would have been great. What if instead of next time you're on the podcast, we'll just send you like some Miller High Lifes?
Oh my God, don't do that. Don't do that. I didn't know what was Miller High Life for like 3 years.
It's the champagne of beers.
Yes, what I wrote one day, I was like, what the fuck is that? And I got drunk on Miller High Life. So that's painful. But yeah, no, I think this is a kind of wine that this is where you really want to approach wine in such a different way. That's the way we've been doing, like, for the last 40 years, I would say, because you pick up the wine and you're like, okay, this is like, if you're technical, you're like, this is an undrinkable wine because there is just too much VA, there is gas, there is everything you want, there is reduction, there is all that. You try to describe it with aromatics, you are kind of at loss because there is just so much happening and it's changing. Like, within, we have been talking for like 53 minutes now, and the wine has been changed already like 10 times, and every mouthfeel is different. And this is, I think, I want to think more and more about wine with potential. I want to think the potential of a wine in terms of how much dynamic can I get in a single sip of a wine, and how much this dynamic is going to explode over a couple of hours. And I think this is a wine with an incredible amount of dynamic and indeed elements that are all over the place right now because they are so strong and powerful because there is so much density in it. There is, like, you can just feel it come from very, very concentrated grape, but concentrated by heat, by soil, by everything. And so you are delivered something that every time you're going to take a sip out of it, you're going to get something new and something exciting.
Like, it's electrifying.
I feel like Shannon, this is what we talk about, like, I'm hard pressed. I mean, there's obviously other examples, but Chenin is one of those grapes that, for all of its like difficulties, like, can deliver exactly what you're talking about, almost better than any other grape can. And in that idea that, like, you're not searching for a perfect final product the minute you open the bottle, but you are looking for something that will challenge you continuously throughout the hour, the 2 hours, the 3 hours that you're drinking it. And Shannon seems to have this extraordinary ability to do that better than a lot of other groups do.
It's never boring. Right. I mean, if it's boring, you've failed your Shannon.
It's the DNA of the grape, the pure shared chemical of the grape allows you to do that. Like that is, and you're right to say that not every grape is equal. They're all very, very different. And Chenin, coming from the right clone, the right rootstock, the right farming, has this ability to get all the cursor up. So this is a few grapes. There is very few white grapes that can do that, which means that you put the acid up, you put the alcohol up, you put the sugar up. They are all here. You put the bitterness and the phenolics up. And Chenin can go very, very high. So you can have everything at 1,000%. And it's going to be still incredibly remarkably drinkable. And so having this ability to have the potential to have all this cursor high, make it even like, it's like an instrument with the largest amount of keys that you can
get. It goes to 11, as they say in Spinal Tap.
Voilà. That's Bibenta. So so you have Mansin can do that, Riesling can do that, Verdicchio can do that.
Mansin can do that.
Mansin can do that.
Everyone says that's the next cool grape to get. That was my question for the end of the episode.
Mansin. They need more Mansin.
Okay, wow.
Carignan Blanc, but Mansin first.
No, fuck Carignan. Really?
Non, Carignan Blanc.
Is that what the kids are drinking?
Yeah. You just wish there is more than 60 hectares planted in France, but
but those are good hectares.
They're
the best hectares. Why?
Carignan Blanc is the next big one. No, Mansing is the next big one, but that's why it was so awesome. Is because you keep this acid. You know, this acid is like off the chart. Yeah. This went through Malo. I'm sure. Yep. Probably in bottle too, so it was a bit fizzy.
Oh yes, it was very fizzy.
13%. You still have some sugar. And having all this stuffing, you just allows this wine to just go endlessly, almost like, and every time acidity is going to pick up, it's going to reveal certain aromatics that you're going to like, and then acidity is going to fall down, it's going to be a bit warmer, you're going to pick up the bitter, and then suddenly you're all the world of an underworld, and you are, and then you go back to the arc, and back and forth. So how much is this wine going to respond to you, and how much is it going to reveal about you? Because it's also being, I think, made in a spirit of being as open as possible to a person that is going to drink it. Because a winemaker is someone that wants that in his wine. I think Francois wants that feeling in his wine.
It's such a chaotic wine. Like, it feels like every part of it is in competition with every other part. So there's this like, you know, like sometimes you'll taste the fruit, you'll taste the bitterness, you'll taste the you'll taste the acid, and they're all kind of vying for like, oh, this is how you describe the wine. But it's a very clever wine. Like it's like everything feels exactly like right at the time, even though my opinion about it changes with every sip. It's a fucking weirdo, but I love it. And Shannon does that, and in a way that, like, I don't know, every other grape doesn't seem to understand.
Yeah, it's. I think also it's something we don't talk enough about. But so first, I think this wine is really a compelling wine. And I once again, I am looking for wine that I revealing stuff about me as much as revealing stuff about them. So every time I want to take a sip, suddenly if I can taste something I never tasted before, I'm extraordinarily happy. Mm-hmm. And that's going to stimulate me even more to drink the wine and to go back and forth and back and forth. So there is this endless stimulation. I want that feeling with the wine. Like, but with Chenin, there is something we never talk about. And I'm not sure if James mentioned it. I have the feeling we had a talk about that at one point. But you know, grapes, they have an age. Mm-hmm. There is an age for the grape variety. So Chenin is quite an old grape variety. Mm-hmm. Sauvignon, the parents, is even older.
Okay.
So there is a rusticity. So just when you start to read a little bit about the genetics of grapes and all that, the older the grapes, the more rustic the grapes, the more phenolic the grapes. They are very, the grape itself developed to sustain itself for so long that they have very specific characteristics that make them quote unquote more rustic. Like a lot of people are talking about, oh, that's a rustic grape. No, it's not necessarily a rustic grape. It's a grape that can be older and kept some of the metabolism that helped the grape to survive. Think about Cabernet Franc versus Cabernet Sauvignon, for example. And Cabernet Franc is always like seen as like greener and more herbaceous and more beet and all. But just Cabernet Franc is older than Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Sauvignon, Sauvignon, and just the adaptation of the grapes, the overall evolution of context of growing was easier for the Cabernet Sauvignon. So the grape didn't have to develop as much certain type of molecular compound to be able to survive. So we have to think about this kind of grapes like that.
Well, to survive, is it that...
You mean evolutionarily?
Yes.
Is it to prevent...
disease, to prevent to be still peaked, to be... But it's a... Yeah, it's a kind of what we call the phenotype of a grape. You have the genotype and you have the phenotype. So it's really about that. Like what kept the grape alive? What did this plant had to do to still be cultivated? So kind of trap us, like played with us to be able to continue to be cultivated by a human, but also to be selected by birds,
it's like how cats didn't domesticate cats. Cats domesticated themselves.
Et ben voilà, it's exactly the same thing with grapes. So and then climate and all that. So why is this grape managed to survive, and what were the tricks and the evolutionary that she took or it took to the neutral stuff to survive? So Chenin is a rusty grape. Chenin is a rusty grape. And so this fact that you have this acid, this phenolic, this skins, the peep and all that, it's an indication that this grape has certain phenolic, certain characteristics that make us what it is today. And when you think about the grape I mentioned that tends to have all this top high cursor, they are also quite ancient grapes. So that's just something to think about, I think, even more in perspective and to...
I had never really thought about it that way. Like the age of a grape existing in the world being this sort of, not qualifier, I guess, but just a identifier of certain characteristics. It's
almost like the ones that can rely on humans don't have to be so tough. Like Sauvignon can't rely on humans to treat it well, so it has to be like an agro machine. And then you move to Chenin Blanc, which is like, you know, still kind of ornery, but is more taken care of. And you move down all the way until you get to like, what is it, like a fucking Sauvignon Blanc, which is just like it has no defenses. It's like, you know,
if you released Yuma into like a wild.
Would never, and she would be the queen of the wild. Have you seen how big her teeth? Yuma, show us your teeth.
Yeah. I don't know if she'd beat a bear.
she would kill a bear.
Oh, probably not. I would I will try to pet the bear, lose my arm. But, you know, this question is really about when people are talking about all this new grape variety, we are hybriding and all that. You know, I think there is this idea of evolutionary that we are never really considering with that. You know, funny, I was listening to a guy the other day, and he's like, you know, it was something about microbes. I'm reading a lot about microbes now. And he's like, try to eat a wild strawberry. Try to eat a wild cabbage. A wild cabbage, you can't eat them because it's cancerogen and you're going to die. But we selected plants that had less tannin, because tannin is a natural, you know, it's a natural protection from the plants to defend themselves.
Right, exactly.
So you just have to think that with all the variety we cultivated and selected and domesticated, the fact that some of them are still very tannic or still have this phenolic, we dumped them, but we also tolerate a certain amount and we kept them this way. But the one we are selecting more and more have less of that. So there is this idea of we are making our surroundings less aggressive. Abrasive and aggressive.
But we do, so, sometimes those of us who are weird like to just like walk that edge, right? Like you want to see edgy. How far you can go.
But I'm pretty sure it's the edge is slightly different now than it could have been 200 years ago.
I would love to go drink wine in the past.
Think about how much
we love that.
How much people loved licorice 100 years ago. Like, that blows my mind. Like, I like a little bit of licorice, but licorice was like the candy. If you had candy, sucks. It was probably licorice at one point. And like that's like, I think that shows like how far, exactly what you're talking about, where like we wanted, you know, that was what candy was. And now we have like cotton candy, which is like this distilled just sugar.
I'm reading cloud. About Roman recipes right now. And it's like, this straight up fucking sucks. I don't want to eat that. Like that's, like, everything is like stuffed into a mold covered with like, you know, like eggs and cream. It's like 1970s cuisine on steroids. It's terrible.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to read something about how comfort food and comfort in general is like really like we are kind of really this idea of a bubble and everything is soft and we are in babies. Yeah, yeah. Mm. And it's everywhere. And I think we can really feel it in wine. I think we are also attracted by certain wines. First, because humans without wine, like we are Homo imbibens, without alcohol, we wouldn't be around. But I think they're also triggering stuff that are reminding of something that is behind the current educational world. Like suddenly we are re-empowered to taste and feel elements that probably were critical for us before.
Yeah.
And we kind of forgot because we don't need them and we are not encouraged. And that is also why I think there is a lot of things happening thanks to the natural wine. Thanks to the experiment, because wine can give us things that we forgot about.
Before World War II, and specifically before like radio was a huge deal, American cuisine was strongly associated with eating squirrel and eating turtles. Turtles were really associated with eating Chesapeake Bay turtles specifically, and like it's crazy. Not that I want to eat a turtle because they're blessed creatures, but the idea, like, we used to eat, and I'm sure that this is true in France as well, like, we used to eat so much different things, and we had a diet which is much more, you know, sauvage, and, like, now we're, the wine's doing that heavy lifting for us in a certain way. Our food system is so domesticated, but, like, the wine all of a sudden is, like, you have this wine and you, maybe just me, you feel like a fucking alpha predator. Like this is,
that's just you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, you're going in the woods, you're ripping a moose's neck out.
Especially before service. Before service, I can't really feel like an alpha predator right now, but that's, I think there's a lot of things to undermine. I think there's a lot of things to think about how much the sugar industry, and then also the fat, but the sugar industry, because fat was designated as the enemy and sugar was kept on.
We've been domesticated.
We have been domesticated, Father, and I would like to know how much that influenced so many more. But there is some studies. I just haven't had time to read them. But the consequences of certain aspect of our brain power. But yeah, I think this is also why wine is attracting so much. I think you had the same phenomenon with the beer and the fact that people really crave for IPA when you are thinking that this specific aromatics and texture was a sign of danger before. So why are we attracting back to that? That probably means that...
Why am I attracted to bad guys? You know, I just don't get it.
I know a good therapist if you want.
Yeah, definitely need that. I think we should move on to the next wine too, because...
I already have. It's and fucking
it's
fabulous.
Delicious. Yeah. So we're in luck.
But you couldn't make me happier with this wine.
It's so lovely. I fucking goddamn it.
It's as challenging and compelling as the last wine is. This is so enveloping and just like kind to me right now. And it's I enjoy both. It's like a Betty and a Veronica. You know, it's like I want to go back and forth between them a little bit. And just
did you hear the third shower of this podcast? By the way.
Look, they're very clean. That's a good thing.
So clean. I don't fucking get it.
We time them. Ah la la, this wine. You make me very happy.
We love these wines. I was very unkind. I earlier this year, I posted a picture of Hunter Biden in a bathtub and said, this is what Koralt's wines taste like. And I still agree with it, but I mean it in a very good and sexy, happy way. Because, like, this wine...
Why Hunter Biden?
Because he was in the news, and he's...
I saw that picture, but have you smelled Hunter?
And this wine fucks. Like, I mean, like, there's no way around it. Like, this wine is very... It's much more relaxed than the first wine. But this is an incredibly sensual wine to me, I think. There's just something about this that's
Yeah.
It's not edgy, but the edges are there, but they're soft. It's gorgeous.
This wine was one of the most difficult for Ben to make. He had a lot of problems with this wine to be made.
I was talking to the importer before this, and apparently this wine, he had to add a little bit of yeast to this specific cuvée to finish fermentation.
It was a terrible year for him for that. But to come back to the relaxed stuff, yeah, you know, the difference is also, Les Pouches is a new vineyard from François. Mm-hmm. It's a vineyard that is sharing with another guy that you probably know, and we like the wine, is Sylvain Dittier from La Porte Saint-Jean. Sylvain, in fact, has the vineyard. Sylvain's vineyard, and took over like 3 years ago, and it was really crappily chemically farmed. Mm-hmm. And so Sylvain has been really working very hard to get back, and it's a very big plot, and so we shared now with Miss Francois. So I think one of the reasons why there's also such a difference between the two wines is we are really talking here about Francois with a vine that have been seriously shaken for years, and they've been just little by little recovering, and that's the 17. So 17, I think, was that's the first vintage, or maybe the second. So you are really talking about vines that were like really, really poorly farmed. Ben Gilbourg, Ben has been making wine since 2005. So Gilbourg changed a little bit plot wise, but we are really talking about somebody that is, look at the vineyard behind me. Like it's, has been loving this parcel and this grapes.
This is the noir soil. This is schist primarily as well, right?
Yeah, it's primarily schist, which makes, I think, less and less of a difference. Less than really how the vine is being just.
You
like
heard
destroyed.
It here first.
I just read a
rocks
book
aren't real.
The opposite of that.
Yeah.
No, I like him right now. I'm going through an existential crisis because I believe that rocks doesn't really matter anymore.
Oh my God. Please tell us more. Tell us more.
As soon as I'm finishing my book, I will tell you more about it.
Is your book called Fuck Rocks? What's
maybe for the American edition.
we'll write the jacket copy if you want. No charge.
Let me call my agent. But so the relaxed side, I think, comes from this, like, I think Benzignard are almost too, like, the love that is spring out in his vine and the beauty of the of makes, with everything that happening, just makes the must even just denser with so much more things that he had a really hard time in 18 ferment everything. And Ben is a very, he's like François, you know, when you don't really know them. I can't really talk more about Ben because I have been knowing him for quite some time now, but you think that they're, you know, hands off, cool, like not really care. They're just minions to the detail. He's like a maniac. But he lost a couple of vintages by wanting to go too far, and you really dump a lot of wine. And when you have two kids, when you have your wife, when you have everything, Ben, I think today is at the top of the game of natural wine region because he has this idea of also making his property and his vineyard work. Like he's not just doing wine to make wine and fucked up and I don't care, and he has proud of what he's doing. He wants you to have a great time with his wine, and he wants to be financially viable because he knows that's for the long run. And so it kind of completes everything that someone, you are mentioning winemakers that just come and go, and you know, they try a couple of vintages, and there is quite of them like that. That on the side, there is one that they stop taking risk because there is too much financial constraint and they don't want to fuck up, and it's been way too hard. And there is the kind of the pure artist that change all the time. And Ben has a free side and just combine it. And today, for me, he makes the best wine in the region.
We're obsessed with his wines. Yeah. We had a bottle with James a million years ago. I can't even get over the color. Color of this wine is so... Because in the glass, it just looks like a Chenin, but when you pour it, there's like this weird, almost pinkish hue to it.
And it glimmers too. I mean, I'm also like, there's sunlight pouring in this window, but the way it caught the sunlight was like
I have prism. A great apartment. That's what you're noticing. Everything looks good there.
Looks like a beautiful loft.
There's this thing that you're talking about.
It's a cool loft.
Pascaline, this thing that you're talking about, like, I think about, like, musicians maybe who are, start out very punk, very, you know, their ethos is very defined. It's like, I don't do this, I don't do that. And then, you know, 10 years later, they finally make a pop record, and it's like the best pop record. Think of, like, when like, David Bowie made Let's Dance, and all of a sudden it's like... You know, he did three difficult ambient records in Berlin, and then he makes like a dance record, and it's like revelatory because you realize that like it's important to also be like beautiful, and like it's not important, but it's also good.
No, you know what I mean? It's important.
It's like
there's
like art and beauty. There's a reason why those things are often compounded, right? Like there's something really endearing about it, and I think when you know, a winemaker recognizes that I can make small decisions that don't challenge my ethos very much, but makes better wine and makes me able to support my family and therefore continue to make better wine. Mm-hmm. That's like the most important revelation a winemaker can make.
This wine is beautiful. It's just straight up like this is
a beautiful wine.
it's delicious, and like, there's like a certain thing.
I love
like,
this wine.
It's not challenging, but it's offering the same things the first wine is too. But it's just everything. It's wearing boxing gloves.
Yeah. It's less raw. I think Francois wine is more raw, and here it's And I think Ben also understood that. First, he wanted to be financially independent. Mm-hmm. Very important. You want to keep the freedom 100%. So you understand also it's step by step and baby steps, and that's, you know. Going back to the music industry, you know, you sign with a big major and you get your bank behind you. Like it's a very different story than you auto-finance your own record and you distribute it. And he also understood that to go to the next step, he had to change things little by little so he can move up and go closer to his growl, and he's getting it every single year. And I know that for that year, putting yeast for him, he couldn't sleep for days.
I imagine it must have killed him.
But you're like I remember because I was around a little bit after he did it, and you're like, let's be serious. You didn't kill anybody. It's not like you said to spray back your vineyard with arsenic or glyphosate.
It's grape juice.
It's grape. And it was like the last one, like it was really like 4 grams of sugar that were not fermenting. I'm like, okay, wine's fantastic. Either you do that or you're going to just, once again, drain it down. Like, you are using a little bit of yeast and just, it's going to be fine. And the wine are going to be fantastic. And we're going to continue to support you because what you're doing in a vineyard and everywhere else is way more important than a tiny bit of yeast. We are all drinking Cellos. Drinking Cellos, selling yeast. Like this. No, and it's showing the way. I think it's also showing the way. And it's like we need more. We need such a change in this viticulture world.
Natural winemakers need kids. They all need to have something to live for other than their fucking wine.
Yeah, but they also need to show that it's possible to live like that. Yes. And to be an alternative for so many more. And we need all these guys to succeed. We need them.
Yes.
So having a tiny bit of, and Ben is such an example for that. We need more of them because, you know, once again, we are right now raving about that situation. You know, the vineyard is definitely going better, Anjou is going more organic, but that's just the iceberg. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the vineyard in the area are still bought by major cooperatives. Mm-hmm. They are not going organic at all. We are talking about a whole different industry. We are still talking about the like 2.1% of France viticulture. So we think it's here because we can drink the wines. This guy, we are talking about them everywhere, but it's just nothing. And there is so much more to be done and so much more because it's national crisis, like it's health crisis, it's everything. So if viticulture can show it's possible to differently, agriculture will do it, we'll eat differently. Like it's way more at stake. So we need this guy to feel like they're absolutely encouraged and to make their business viable.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah,
I also think it's something that we haven't talked about enough on this season, and we've had this problem in other seasons where we forget to talk about the sort of existential crises that climate change is that's happening everywhere. But I mean, the difficulty in the Loire with frost and like...
Oh, I cannot even imagine
this. It's something we should at least acknowledge that these people are also, on top of everything else, on top of farming Chenin and trying to do it right, and on top of trying to make this low intervention wine that you can feed your family on, they're also fighting, you know, capitalism raging against climate all over the globe. And it's like not something we should just gloss over, which we too often do on this podcast, unfortunately.
Will almost certainly be too hot at the end, but will start out too cold in a very fun way. It's such a challenge. And like,
yeah, it's, you know, but Ben, once again, is showing a model because, you know, he has a vine and is where he getting most of his income, but he's very well aware, and his wife too, that she may have a side job, and they also, polyculture is something they are, you know, thinking back again, you know, so they are part of these pioneers, a bit more mature with already a market, important distributors, M&M and all that, but seeing that we indeed need to change the model, because monoculture, even if you do it in a more regenerative way, but you are still dealing with one crop, is not going to work out. We know that just because climate change, how much you want to call it and what the consequences, we know that there is just too many changes happening right now. So like us with COVID, you realize that you can't just do one thing unless, I don't know, you're Jeff Bezos or you have Amazon and you just want to destroy the world. But you have to have multiple acts. Like we are not made to be analytic and go just down one road. Like we need to multiple eggs and just have all this stuff working in a synergy together. And that would be one of the solutions in the future for this rain, because then they're all starting to realize that one crop makes maybe less sense than we thought. And the time that the rest of the world change, it would be already too late. So,
I mean, historically, this region was, they were farmers of many fucking things.
Like a lot of region, like it's only two generations that grapes became number one. It used to be polyculture and multiple stuff. In Anjou, it was a lot of horses, a lot of pear, a lot of apples, a lot of grain cereal. So yeah, it was polyculture. Everybody was doing
great wine out of horses.
But it's how like we talk about mouse, but it's wine. Like horse and mouse. There is an historical reason.
They should be growing a Syrah there, yes.
But it's it's part of what's gonna need to happen in the future, and all thinking about it. But how do you change that? And it's funny how things change so quickly, and how it's gonna take some time to undo it. But this is also we need to realize we need to be more political, because a lot of the problems these guys are facing also not decided locally anymore. They are deciding in Brussels. A lot of, you know, monies, let's say you can get a bunch of subvention from Europe, but it means that you just do monoculture with clones and you don't work organically, and then you get money. If you want to change your model and say, I want to do a farm, multi-polyculture, regenerative, I just want to work with heirloom stuff, you have zero money. So like being political and realizing that there is stuff where as a citizen, plus as a group, an association you can be part of, really makes sense more than ever today. So you can help these guys to get this funding instead of going to one way and the way that we don't want them to go today, to shift that money around and to help to make that transition. Because if suddenly you have €100,000 given by Europe to change the way you are, it's a whole different ballgame that you have to build by yourself.
I mean, if Europe wanted to pay me, I would stop swearing on this podcast.
Hey, but you need to start to lobby in Brussels.
Yeah.
Like French fries and beer.
Oh, here I am, yeah. French fries and beer and Schwarzbiet.
Hey, but voilà. Go to Belgium, go to the parliament and talk to them in Strasbourg. But that's also a thing we don't realize, that a lot of the decisions today are still made with this kind of... And it's a little bit in your different... And, here in the US, but Europe is still under so much regulation that doing something different right now, this way, is not at all supported financially nor legally by Europe. And it's a big problem.
We are an anti-Brussels podcast. I think it's safe to say we don't believe in Belgium.
I don't even eat Brussels sprouts. That's how far I go.
I eat them, but it's a cruel joke when I eat them. It's like, oh, here I am eating the politicians.
Belgium is, yes, I worked in 1 year in Belgium. I had really a great
time. I'm so sorry. I used to go to a Belgian bar when I lived in London. And I would get food poisoning every time, and I didn't know what was wrong. I was like, I have to go here. It's the only place I can get cold beer in this fucking city.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But
terrible country. But maybe better than the UK, but that's not saying much.
Oh, la la. But no, but it's, listen, it's like, it's happening. It's harder than we think. And what was really cool is to see that a lot of the support that a bunch of these guys have is from outside of France. Mm-hmm. Without Japan, without the American market, I think the situation for the film and the world will be very different today. And finally, France is realizing that, oh, wow, that we should take this guy seriously. So it's what happened and the love and the care and like the support that America gave has been really, really critical, and will be critical the next year. That's for sure. So it's really, really cool to see that happen.
So people should probably go to Racine's, spend a lot of money on Loire wine, right? And then it'll trickle back up, and then France will know.
Saving industry. But Racine or anywhere, there is a thing. I think today New York is a pretty amazing place to drink wine. I think
a really fucking good place to drink wine.
I think we are very lucky in New York, for access with COVID kind of cut us down restaurant, but I think with retail, like, you have so many great retail today that are pushing the right thing in the right way, and the access is really, really top.
We're drinking a Sauvignon Blanc that you recommended from Chambers right after this.
Mm-hmm.
For the bonus episode. Apparently you write the descriptions for the wines there, which is great. That's
Well, I did that a little bit last year. Yeah, I had a little bit of free time.
Right? It's hard to imagine you have any free time. I like how earlier you're like, I haven't read those papers yet. Like, oh, I'm so lazy. Like, yeah, okay. Like, you seem very busy. It's understandable.
Yeah, I don't fucking read any papers. I see a paper, I throw a paper out. Fuck that.
I'm not sure about that.
I only watch YouTube.
I see the glasses. I can imagine you like.
I don't even need these. This is just to impress people. I can see perfectly. I'm a jock.
What are you drinking after?
Vincent's wine.
His wines are fabulous. His Sancerre Rouge was so good. We're gonna give his Sancerre Blanc a chance.
Eh ben oui. What's coming this summer is really gonna be even better. It's on the way. It's like miam. Next level shit.
I think we probably are wrapping up. Pascaline, is there anything you want to kind of finish saying about Chenin Blanc specifically, or about Loire in general? I mean, you've touched on a lot, right?
I just hope it's really if you're a wine lover, just go there one day. You know, I think everybody wants to go to and praising all this region, but. There is something.
Fuck Burgundy. Go to the Loire.
the cruelest thing about La Dive is that it's in February. Like, the only time I've ever been in the Loire, it's been so cold and wet. And I've been twice, and both times I've like been the coldest I've ever been. Like, living in a building of stones, drinking too much, forgetting to eat, being like, this is the Loire. I thought it was supposed to be pretty. What's going on?
You were at twice at Lady when she did at Ackermann. It was at you did, because you know she did it 1 year at Chateau de Brézé,
right?
Where everybody lost an arm to the cold, like even the champagne guy were like, it's too cold for a champagne. For the champagne guy to say that is always
too cold,
like,
for champagne is impossible.
I always feel like, I feel so bad for the Spanish guys who are just like, what is this? What's going on?
Why are we here? Our country is nice. What the fuck?
it brings a charm. Come on. It makes you drink more and look like everybody was missing La Dive this year, and hopefully it will happen next year. We don't know yet. We need to pray. And Sylvie can't use any more Ackerman, so we, I know she, it's too bad because it's under, like, I really love this. That was one of the good things with all this tasting when you go there, when you're a pro, and when you're not a pro, you can still go. You just need to pay. So, but both, like, they were all in this really magnificent spot, you know, like it makes such a difference when you taste this kind of wine in this kind of context. But hopes are going to happen next year. But no, I just really, it's the region when where you go, you, it's just going to change you, because people are just I think you're really meeting real deal people when you go there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's with an industry and a wine world that is continuing to change in a very specific direction. It's really down to earth and kind of remind you a couple of fundamentals. So I just hope, and we need to drink more Chenin. Yeah. Once again, you know, we think it's a revolution, but Chenin is being pulled out.
Chenin.
They need to stop pulling out the vine. You know? They need to replant. We need more Chenin.
It's still more planted in South Africa than in France, right? That's still true.
Yeah. And it's still, like, until last year, they were still pulling out vine every year. So it was still decreasing. So it's really not doing that great. Yeah. So
it's a nice reminder that the shit that nerds in New York City care about is not at all what normal people care about.
Yeah.
So we need to continue. Bring Chenin to your mother, like, for Thanksgiving.
I would never bring Chenin to my mother. Like,
brings...
We need to get the guys who got the Snyder cut Chenin. Made, get them into Chenin Blanc, and then we'll just release the Chenin cut.
I saw my mother for the first time in a long time recently, and we drank a corked bottle of wine. And I said, "This wine is corked." My mother said, "Stop acting like you're too good for your home." And I said, "Okay." I tried to explain what corking was, and she was like, "You don't like this wine." I'm like, "It's not a question of if I like it. The wine is corked." And she said, "You're just like your father." So
I would like to mention, I met your mom and I thought she was lovely.
And also, I am nothing like my father. That's for certain.
Guys,
but thanks a lot for having me. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to go to my
Pascaline,
real job.
Enjoy doing thanks real again. Work. We wouldn't know what that's like. Thank you so much.
We love you so much. Come back anytime. You're the best.
Come by the restaurant. We can will. Continue to that. That's great to have you guys. So.
Yeah, crabsolutely. That sounds fun.
Thanks, Pascaline.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Dis gorgeous.